Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture titled The Gender Revolution in the Philippines, Children and Transnational Mothers. Speaking will be Rosel Pereñas, Professor of American Civilization and Sociology at Brown University. Tonight's lecture is sponsored by the Boston University Center for the Study of Asia in cooperation with the Boston University Department of Sociology. We begin with an introduction by Sociology Department Associate Professor Nazli Kibria.
It is my distinct pleasure here to welcome Rosel, who is a professor of American Civilization and Sociology at Brown University. Rosel has worked most recently at the University of California, Davis. She received her degrees from the University of California, Berkeley, her PhD in 1998. From the Comparative Ethnic Studies Department, with a designated emphasis in women, gender, and sexuality. She has several books. Her first book, 2001, was called The Servants of Globalization, Women, Migration, and Domestic Work. And then in 2005, a book that I've assigned, and I know is assigned widely, called The Children of Global Migration, Transnational Families, and Gendered Woes. And she has several forthcoming books as well, including one that is called Trafficked: Morals, Migration, and Foreign Hostesses in Tokyo's Nightlife Industry. So I'd like you to please welcome Rosel here today, and we will hear her for about 40 minutes or so and then have time for questions and answers. Thank you.
Thanks for having me here. Today I'm going to give a talk entitled The Gender Revolution in the Philippines, Migrant Care Workers and Social Transformations. But I think I put childhood there as well in the other title that I think I gave you. This talk draws from my second book, Children of Global Migration, which looks at the experiences of children of migrant workers who have been left behind in the Philippines. So between 2000 and 2001, I spent 18 months in the Philippines to do work on these children who have been left behind by their migrant parents. And they constitute about 25% of the overall youth population in the Philippines. So when I was there, I met a 21-year-old woman who I'm going to call Isabel. And she casually told me in one of our many conversations, she told me, quote, "When I was 7 years old, my mom went to Malaysia first for 1 to 2 years. Then she went to Saudi Arabia. And then from Saudi Arabia, she went straight to the United States. When she went to the United States, that was the longest, 10 years, that we did not see each other at all. She came back, and when we saw each other, I was already 21 years old," unquote. So Isabel's mom is a domestic worker who first worked in Malaysia, she said, then Saudi Arabia, and then lastly the U.S. She left Isabel under the care of an aunt. So Isabel's childhood is actually pretty typical and not so unusual in the Philippines because, like I said, about 25% of the overall youth population there are children of migrant workers. And so they constitute about 9 million children. And so these are kids that are 18 years old and below. So when I say kids, we're also looking at, you know, like teenagers. So a lot of them are children of migrant domestic workers, but not all of them. We know, however, that most of them are kids of these migrant domestic workers who are working in 160 countries around the world, cleaning households and caring for the elderly and children in countries in East and West Asia, North America, and Western Europe. And so in Europe alone, we find a large number of them, of these domestic workers, of the mothers of children such as Isabel, working in Great Britain, in France, the Netherlands, Italy, Spain, and Greece. So because of the demand for migrant domestic workers in rich countries throughout the world, we are witnessing tremendous social transformations in countries such as the Philippines. The migration of women is rupturing the traditional gender division of labor in the family. Migration makes breadwinners out of women, not only in the family, but also in the nation. So the labor of women, for instance, generates the two largest sources of foreign currency in the Philippines, and that's electronics manufacturing and labor migration. So even the president of the Philippines concedes to the economic dependence of the nation on migrant labor telling migrant workers to, quote, stay abroad, unquote, because, as she explains to them, quote, jobs here in the Philippines are difficult to find, and we are depending on the people outside the country. If you can find work there and send money to your relatives here, then perhaps you should stay over there, unquote. However, it's not just overseas workers per se that she's telling to stay away, but it's women, many of whom, like I said, are children. And so we have to note then that it's, so the president, when she tells migrant workers to stay there, she's also telling the mother of Isabel to stay away from her family, right? So from the perspective of gender relations in the sending country, there are two ways we could think about women's migration, the migration of Isabel's mother. First, we could see it as indicative of remarkable gender transformations. It not only leads to the greater income earning power of women and their greater contributions to the household, but it also forces the redefinition of mothering. They show us that biological mothers need not be the primary caretakers of their children. In other words, we could argue that women's migration is some sort of victory for feminism, right? Then the second perspective that we could take is to view women's migration as a tragedy, one that results in the forcible separation of children, such as Isabel, from their mothers. This latter view seems to be the dominant perspective in the Philippines, where the public looks at women's migration as a tragedy that leads to the suffering of children. So in this view, women's migration comes to represent the status of the Philippines as an economically unstable country. It is assumed that women would not migrate and leave their children behind if they had better labor market options in the Philippines. So this view bewails the separation of children from their biological mothers, and as such, it inadvertently calls for a return to the nuclear family, and it upholds the ideology of women's domesticity. So today, what I would like to do is make sense of why society sees the separation of children and mothers as a tragedy and not so much a victory for feminism. And so I intentionally began with the stunning example of Isabel. I did so not just to call attention to her plight, but to call attention to the social lives of migrant domestic workers from the perspective of the home society. And so I think it's important that we realize that migrant domestic workers are not only negotiating their settlement, let's say, where, you know, in the country of destination, but that but they're also always negotiating their relationship with the sending country, and that they're always maintaining social relations with people in the sending country in the process of migration. And so I want to look particularly at how they've negotiated the social transformations that have been triggered by their migration. So in the Philippines, the public views children such as Isabel as victims who have been abandoned by their mothers. The public dismisses women's migration as not just bad for the welfare of children such as Isabel, but dangerous to the sanctity of the family. Interestingly, the public does not disdain migrant fathers like they do migrant mothers. So the prevailing view in the Philippines is that if one parent must migrate, it's better that a father and not a mother does so. The negative view associated with women's migration seems to haunt migrant mothers not only in the Philippines, but also in many other sending countries, including Poland and Romania. For example, a recent article in the New York Times describes the out-migration of women as a, quote, national tragedy, unquote, that has triggered social upheaval in Romania. The article blames not only the collapse of the Romanian family, but also the abandonment and delinquency of children on the migration of women. So in this article, the migration of mothers is said to result in severe psychological difficulties among children and even suicide for a sizable number of them. So the goal of my lecture then is to make sense of the vilification of migrant mothers in countries such as the Philippines and Romania, and to understand the moral compulsion to equate their migration with abandonment of children. After all, migrant mothers do provide for the children that they leave behind with monthly remittances, and moreover, they see to the daily care of their children by other kin. The fact is, women are attempting to reconstitute mothering via labor migration, but society seems to resist their efforts and insists on holding them accountable to the ideology of women's domesticity. The outcome is to naturalize mothering at the expense of the social transformations that are encouraged by women's labor and migration. So in this lecture, what I'd like to point out is that the problems of children such as Isabel are not so much caused by their mother's migration, but instead by the resistance against the efforts of migrant mothers to redefine mothering. More specifically, the romanticization of biological mothering, along with the refusal of sending societies such as Poland, the Philippines, and Romania to recognize the reconstitution of the gender division of labor in the family that's spurred by women's migration, aggravates the emotional difficulties of children. So illustrating the ideological belief that women's rightful place is in the home, headlines on May 26, 1995, from two of the largest circulating newspapers in the Philippines read, quote, overseas employment a threat to Filipino families, and quote, Ramos says Pinay, like Filipina, overseas contract workers threaten Filipino families, unquote. So in a speech delivered by to the Department of Social Welfare the day prior to the release of these newspaper reports, the president of the Philippines had called for initiatives to keep migrant mothers at home. As the president said, quote, we are not against overseas employment of Filipino women. We are against overseas employment at the cost of family solidarity, unquote. So by calling for the return migration of mothers, President Ramos did not necessarily disregard the increasing economic dependency of the Philippines on the foreign remittances of its mostly female migrant workers. However, he did make clear that only single and childless women are those who are morally acceptable to pursue labor migration. So agreeing with the president's reprimand of migrant mothers is their vilification in public discourse and the media's pathological depiction of their families. So in news media reports, the media often claims that the migration of women would result in the instability of family life and the use of, quote, drugs, gambling, and drinking, quote, unquote, among children. The media, in so doing, presumes that women leaving their children behind will naturally be bad for children. So in the course of doing so, they're vilifying the migration of migrant mothers. But then what's really interesting that absent in their discussion are the role of men in the family. So then they're just leaving us to assume that the men that have been left behind will just be naturally incompetent caregivers. And so what we do see is that prevailing public discourse has not really reconstituted gender notions of the family. And this tells us that women are suffering from a backlash in their efforts to redefine mothering. So public discourse in the media does not disagree with mainstream views in the community concerning mothers and the welfare of their families. So during my research in the area of the Philippines where I did my study, I visited 10 different towns and met with community members, they're either parents, they're guardians of children that have been left behind by a migrant parent. In these focus group discussions with members of migrant families in these 10 different towns, I'd often leave the focus group discussions quite stunned by the depressing accounts that they would tell me about the situation of the children of migrant mothers. So in one focus group, for instance, the participants told me, quote, so one said they are neglected, these are the children. Second, abandoned. Third, no one is there to watch over the children. Four, the attitudes of children change. Five, they swim in vices. Six, the values you like disappear. Seven, they take on vices. Eight, men take on mistresses. Then the ninth person said, oh, yes, that's true, that's true. And so what's really interesting is then after I looked at all these focus group discussions, I realized that all the people who participated in my focus group discussions were members of the families of migrant fathers, and they had plenty of things to say about the families of migrant mothers, but they had not much to say about their own families. And then, but this is another story why the migrant mothers' families were not represented in these samples. But just to say something briefly about that, I think they're so stigmatized in the community that they don't even participate in these. So I contacted these groups through the Overseas Workers Welfare Administration. And so what's interesting is that they're so stigmatized, I think, that they don't even really deal with the government agency that's supposed to give them support. So they're quite absent, is what I found. The children of the families of migrant mothers in various community support organizations. So the negative view of migrant mothers in the public, I have to say, adversely affects the experiences of children such as Isabel. What I found is that it does not only absolve fathers of the responsibility to care for their children, but it also makes it difficult for children to recognize the unorthodox ways that they receive care in light of their mother's migration. So if one were to talk to children of migrant mothers, one would easily assume that they do not receive any care at all. They often describe their situation as one of quote-unquote abandonment, and so this is the word they often use. One, however, has to read between the lines. A closer look at the situation will show that children are not necessarily abandoned and left without adequate care. Instead, what they often mean by abandonment is not the absence of day-to-day maternal care, but the denial of physical intimacy from their biological mothers. So generally, children uphold biological-based views on mothering. In so doing, they believe that it's impossible for mothers to provide care from a distance. They also assume that the work of extended kin, including those who they call mom, could not adequately substitute for whatever care they imagine their biological mother will give them. So children often describe the care that their migrant mothers provide them from a distance as, quote, never enough, unquote. Likewise, they insist that the care extended by other relatives would never match what they assume would be naturally better care that their mother would provide them if she didn't migrate, if she had not migrated. So we see this in the situation of one 17-year-old son of a migrant domestic worker who had been working in a Middle Eastern country for more than 11 years. So the mom left when he was six. So this young man grew up in a close-knit family. His aunt took an active role in his parenting, walking him to school every day, meeting with his teachers regularly, helping him with his homework every night, and spending a lot of quality time with him while his mother worked as a domestic worker in Kuwait, particularly. But this young man describes that he didn't receive, he describes the care that he receives from his aunt as, quote, not enough, unquote. So I didn't really know what more would be than that, right? And even though his mother actually visited him like every year in the Philippines, he still didn't think that the care he received was not enough. And he told me that he thinks that his mother's care would have just been better than whatever his aunt gave him. So even though he personally has never experienced any intensive caring acts from his mother from up close, really, he assumes that his mother would just do a better job of walking him to school, helping him with his homework, cooking him breakfast, and so on, right? So Roan tells me, this young man tells me, quote, what is right is for my mother to be by my side. The love that I received from a father and mother was not enough. I received a lot of love from my aunts and my grandmother, but that was it, unquote. So similarly, the affection of fathers is believed not to be interchangeable with those of mothers. For instance, a young college student who I called Phoebe told me, quote, I do not know if I could identify the love of my parents when I was growing up. We should have grown up with my mother. Then she would have been the one taking care of our needs. And your father, I asked her, doesn't he live with you? Did he take care of your needs? And then she told me, sort of, but surely the way a mom takes care of you is different from the way a father does. Isn't that right? Unquote. So children often assume that the gender division of labor between mothers and fathers is natural. Fathers discipline and mothers nurture. Fathers provide financial stability and mothers will ensure emotional stability. So not surprisingly, Phoebe thinks that she would have had a more stable upbringing if her mother had stayed at home. And so perhaps she also feels this, so I do have to admit that the mother did leave behind an alcoholic and jobless husband to work in Hong Kong. But however, her mother does call frequently enough to know the weekly routine of Phoebe and her sisters, and that she has financially supported Phoebe and her sisters throughout through school. So the ideology of women's domesticity haunts the families of migrant mothers and burden women as they struggle in other countries. Mothers may economically provide for their children, but not to the extent that it would free them, even if only partially, of the responsibility to nurture the family. Expressing the shortfalls of distance mothering, Marinelle is another name I gave them, gave this woman, asserts the inadequacy of care that she received from her mother when she states, quote, my mother's love was not enough. You see that, like, not enough keeps on coming up. I would have wanted her next to me so that I could feel her love. I feel it, but only a little bit. I know she loves me because she is working hard over there. She is working hard so that we could have everything we want and everything we need. Even when she is sick, she continues to work. But still, I want her to be with me here every day. It's because, since I was small, it was only my grandparents showing me love. She was not here, unquote. So children like Marinelle often recognize the economic contributions of their mothers, but they do not accept it to the extent that it would free their mothers of the responsibility of nurturing, of having to nurture them in proximity. So children are not likely to accept a reconstituted form of mothering, one that redefines mothering to be that of a good provider, because they tend to hold on to staunch moral beliefs regarding the family, holding in high regard the conventional nuclear family. So Teresa Bascara, is another name I gave her, it's a pseudonym, a daughter of a domestic worker in Hong Kong, told me, for example, quote, you cannot say it is a family if your mother and father are not there with you. It's like it's not a whole family if your father and mother are not here, if they are far. A family, I can say, is only whole if your father is the one working and your mother is only staying at home. It's okay if your mother is working too, but somewhere close to you, not somewhere far away, unquote. So sentiments such as those held by Teresa illustrate the ideological stronghold of the conventional nuclear family among children of migrant mothers. This ideology is inculcated to them not only by the media and the state, as we saw with the comments earlier by President Fidel Ramos, but also by religious institutions, which, as I noted in the community, where I did research, rarely did they ever address the plight of transnational mothering in their weekly services, or transnational families in general. Schools, I should note, also did not acknowledge the presence of transnational migrant families among their constituents. So in the Philippines, what's interesting is that they have what you call a family values class. So this is a state-mandated class. That's one of the requirements that schools have to give to this, one of the subjects that school have to give to their students. And what's interesting is looking at the curriculum of various family values classes in the area where I did research, not one of these families mentioned migrant families, even though the area where I did research had such a high population proportion of migrant families in there. And so so consequently, what happens is because various institutions in the community, from schools to churches to those community groups, don't really provide support to transnational families, especially to the families of migrant mothers, I think it promotes children's belief that they are being raised in the wrong kind of family. And so not surprisingly then, because children are not getting reassurance that their families are, quote, normal, they often describe to me their families as, quote, unquote, broken, which is a term that is used in the Philippines to refer to deficient households. So pretty much non-nuclear households are often called broken. But I want to point out that families tend to be broken not because children have been abandoned by their mothers in the process of migration, but because the migration of their mothers threatens the organization of gender in society. So the ideological stronghold of the nuclear family also hurts the welfare of the children of migrant mothers, because it does facilitate the rejection of care work by the fathers who are left behind in the Philippines. So I found that in spite of the greater economic contributions of migrant women to the family, fathers do not increase the amount of their household responsibilities if they've been left behind by a migrant wife. Instead, what they do is they leave it to other women, daughters, domestic workers, aunts, and grandmothers, to do the care work that had been left by their wives upon migration. And so this situation is reminiscent of what Arlie Hochschild describes as the stalled revolution in the 1980s among dual-income-earning couples in the United States. Men then, likewise, did not increase their housework despite women's greater economic contributions in the household. So we should look at the rejection of housework by men back then and today as not only a stall, however, but a form of protest. So by rejecting women's work, fathers left behind in the Philippines are doing their share of gender boundary work in the family. They are resisting the redistribution of labor that's being forced by women's greater economic contributions to the household income, and thereby they're helping keep the conventional gender division of labor intact. However, fathers left behind, I should say, do not completely turn their back on the needs of their children. Some men do provide care. For instance, working class men have found themselves having to do housework as they are without resources to hire other women. In contrast, middle class men often can hire domestic workers. But regardless of class, if men do housework, I did find that they do not do that much. The women left behind, eldest daughters, aunts, grandmothers, and domestic workers, still do more care work than fathers. So men's rejection of housework hurts women in the family. Female extended kin, I found, resent the burden of care that they feel obligated to perform as women. Meanwhile, the education of eldest daughters often suffers because of their greater responsibilities after their mother leaves. So this, for instance, happened to Isabel, who complained to me that her grades dramatically got lower after her mother migrated. Yet the absence of fathers is not invisible to children, including Isabel, who complained to me, quote, "It's annoying. I cannot help but feel resentful. It's because my father is here, but he does not care. He does not support us, especially when it comes to school," unquote. So Isabel notes that her mother actually does a lot more care work than her father. As she told me, quote, "My mother is the one far away, but she is the one who is close. It's because I think that my father is there physically, but he does not care. He does not get involved with us. My mother, even if she is outside the country, minds our business," unquote. But not all children recognize, however, the care work that migrant mothers provide. So Isabel is kind of exceptional in that case. More often, I found that they blame their mothers for the inadequacy of their care rather than their physically present but emotionally absent fathers. By insisting on the minimal work of men, I'm not implying that the institutional rearrangement of the household has not forced some of them to take on certain aspects of women's work. For example, I met this man, Lorenzo, I called him, who had to quit his job as a security guard and found himself the stay-at-home father of an 11-year-old son upon the sudden death of his mother, the son's grandmother. The situation of Lorenzo suggests that women's migration makes the reconstitution of the gender division of labor unavoidable in some families. But interestingly, Lorenzo does not think of the care that he does for his son as women's work, but instead he considers the work he does to be an extension of his previous duties in the military. Describing the cooking and cleaning he must now do at home, Lorenzo told me, quote, "This is just the skills I learned during my military training as a soldier. I was trained to do this work as a soldier," unquote. So we can imagine that Lorenzo as a soldier can only perform domestic chores without the emotional labor of affection. So we can imagine then, and actually this is true, that this limits the kind of care that his 11-year-old son receives now after the death of his grandmother and the absence of his migrant mother. So it also indicates to us that even men who can't completely resist the gender transformations in the family, kind of really try to hold on to it as much as they could. So as suggested by the case of Lorenzo, however, men cannot always avoid female gendered care work. These are usually the mundane tasks we often overlook, but carry with them in their performance far-reaching gender implications. They include grocery shopping, attending meetings at school, doing various activities in public with their children, such as walking them to school. These activities underscore and make visible the absence of mothers from the country. Although men seem to resist the changes forced by the institutional rearrangement of their households, and I should note that in my study, for instance, most of the fathers of the children of migrant mothers I interviewed relocated to another island of the Philippines. So they didn't have to walk the kid to school, right? Lorenzo was one of them, but then when his mother died, he had to go back to his son, so he had no choice. But then, so even though they really try to resist and they relocate to another island, they've sometimes found themselves, like Lorenzo did, with no other choice but to adjust accordingly to their new household arrangement. So this fact does leave us with a glimmer of hope that transformations in gender ideologies could eventually follow suit in the transnational families of migrant mothers. So let me now conclude my discussion by stating that what we are seeing in the Philippines is a gender revolt, in other words, a resistance against the reconstitution of the gender division of labor in the family that is led by the migration of women. This resistance adversely affects the welfare of children. It results in feelings of neglect among them simply because they are not receiving care conventionally. The care provided by mothers from a distance and those given by extended female kin up close are constructed as not enough. Moreover, this resistance facilitates men's rejection of care work, which in turn aggravates the difficulties that children do face when their mothers migrate. So we should recognize that the family is not a static institution. As Judith Stacey has told us, we are now in the age of the postmodern family in which economic realities can no longer sustain a dominant household structure, but instead has ushered the formation of multiple household forms, including single-parent, dual-wage-earning, conventional nuclear, and I would add to this, transnational migrant households. Children do not necessarily receive optimal care in conventional nuclear households. However, the notion that biological mothers should nurture their children somehow retains its ideological stronghold. We see this in various sending countries of migrant care workers, not only in the Philippines, but as I noted earlier, that was also the case in Romania and Poland. And so we see the same situation in Sri Lanka, actually, where, as it is the case in the Philippines, a common solution posed to the problems of children in transnational families is to call for the return migration of mothers. So as recently as 2007, for instance, the cabinet of Sri Lanka, in acknowledging the emotional difficulties that children of migrant mothers confront, passed legislation that prohibited mothers with children below 5 years of age from working overseas. The government of Sri Lanka never implemented this law, but neither did the government renounce it. So as I tried to describe in this talk, a solution that upholds the ideological belief that biological mothers are the most suitable caregivers of children only aggravates the problems of these children. Without question, it makes it more difficult for them to adjust to their new family form, the transnational family that's been spurred on them by processes of economic globalization. But why is there a gender revolution against women's emancipation? Is it only because any drastic social transformation poses a threat to society? I believe that countries like Sri Lanka and the Philippines retain the ideology of women's domesticity because it is in the vested interest of their economies for them to do so. Despite the push for women to work outside the home, it is to the interest of these nations to keep the ideology of women's domesticity intact because it supplies them with a labor pool to fill the demand for women's low-wage labor by more developed nations in the global economy. The retention of gender does not occur in a vacuum, but takes shape in the context of economic globalization. So in the Philippines, for instance, the jobs in demand for women to fill, domestic work and assembly line manufacturing work, retain the assumption of women's natural aptitude for caring and nurturing. Second, the ideology of women's domesticity, as it justifies the wage gap and sex segregation in the labor market, ensures the low wage of women. In so doing, it secures foreign currency for the Philippines. It does so by not only driving women out of the local economy to seek the higher wages of migrant domestic work, but it also retains the low wages of women and thereby attracts foreign manufacturing companies in search of locales that can offer the lowest overhead costs in the global economy. The low wages of Filipino women is, in fact, the mainstay of the attractiveness of the Philippine labor force in the global economy. So if the global economy demands the retention of the ideology of women's domesticity in the Philippines, then we should be mindful that its retention is not only spurred by traditional values and cultures. In other words, we should not dismiss the Philippines and Sri Lanka as more patriarchal than countries with more developed economies such as the United States. Fueling and dictating the retention of the ideology of domesticity in these countries are the foreign influences of more developed nations in search of docile workers in factories and maternal figures to care for children and elderly in their homes. In other words, it is our demand for nannies in richer countries that is equally accountable for the retention of the ideology of women's domesticity in countries such as the Philippines, and the ideology that makes it very difficult for Isabel to adjust to her new household form. So if it is not just our demand for nannies, but also our need for the maternal figure of the nanny that is responsible for the challenges of transnational life that are confronted by nannies and their children, such as Isabel, we are left with a question of how could we ease their emotional difficulties. So perhaps richer nations should earmark development aid towards the welfare of children such as Isabel. Programs that would promote the recognition of transnational families in schools, churches, and the community would without doubt normalize the experiences of children such as Isabel. Dismantling the ideology of women's domesticity would likewise encourage them to accept the unconventional ways they receive care. But more significantly, perhaps, receiving countries should make the option of family reunification available to migrant workers and their children. Notably, a call for the return migration of mothers for the sake of family reunification could send the wrong message to women to stay at home. This would undoubtedly threaten the gender advancements they have made in the process of migration. However, we should be aware that the choice for Isabel to live in close proximity of her mother is a human right that has been denied to her and most other children of migrant workers in countries as far-flung as the Netherlands and Taiwan. So as an alternative means of family reunification, we should perhaps then consider the solution of family reunification in the host society instead of return migration, as this option will allow migrant mothers to better balance their work and family life. Family reunification in the host society would recognize not only the right of our migrant nannies to a family life, but also their right to work outside the home. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your amazing lecture. I actually had a question, because when you mentioned that Sri Lanka had started that law, you know, preventing mothers to go abroad after the age of five, if they were to do that in the Philippines, like, did they provide any type of compensation for these families since, you know, these mothers weren't given a chance to or don't have that opportunity to go abroad?
Your question actually brings me back to a conversation that I had with Nazli on our way over here. And so the question is, what if migrant mothers are told to stay at home? Are there any economic compensations for them to do so? The Philippines has long had a program to encourage migrants to no longer go abroad also, but to stay at home. So while, let's say, President Arroyo is encouraging them to go abroad because there are no jobs in the Philippines, they also want to encourage migrants to create jobs. So they create jobs by constructing small businesses. So what they will do is they will loan money to return migrants to help them start a business, and then they will teach them some basic business skills. But the business skills they teach them are not very advanced, you know, so they don't take macroeconomics classes, let's say, in the university. That's not happening. Instead, what they will do is they will identify, like, what you could call, like, role model returned migrants. So let's say one returned migrant successfully opened a business. The government has this, I don't know, they like to do this. They'll take that person as an example, and then they'll showcase that person, and then they will have that person teach the skill that they learned to share with other people. So I have the best example, which is someone learned how to make pickled fish like this that was preserved, and she had a very successful business. So then they had her teach 500 women how to make a pickled fish in hopes that those some of those 500 women will stay behind and also sell pickled fish. But you can imagine the logic there, which is like you're going to oversaturate the market with pickled fish. So then the poor woman who first like had that successful business, she's going to have so much competition that she's probably going to have to go abroad again. But that was the class that I saw them like when I actually went to a class to how to encourage people to stay in the Philippines. That was the class I saw. I couldn't believe it. But yeah, so it's like a long-winded answer to your question is, yes, they have these programs, but from that one brief event that I saw, it's like, I don't know how successful these programs are and how effective they are. Yeah, but they try.
I thought it was it's a very interesting story, and opens up, I think, a window into a world that even though a lot of us have encountered the migrant workers themselves and have only imagined ourselves in the positions. And so it's very interesting to you know, get the primary research. And I thought it was also very interesting the way in which you show the you know, some of the social structures get replicated domestically, you know, the family yeah. values, classes, and this and that. But I wonder if you could tell the story without hanging your hat on a couple of the things that I think actually aren't necessary. For example, you're using the in challenging this the idea of you know, certain norms of the way that families are supposed to work, you may actually be making some presumptions about how plastic these things are. So things like care at a distance, which is it's the first time I've ever heard the term, and I've been working on getting my emotional mind around it. I have little kids. And also, you know, there seems to be a little bit of a presumption of the substitutability of caregiving between the aunt and the mother. Yeah. And you know, we all know, of course, that it's not just a question of material or even action, yeah. but that there is probably some level of longing between a mother and a child who presumably yeah. did some bonding early on. And so I think you probably don't need that part of the presumption to still make a fabulous case. And I wonder if you think it's important, or maybe I missed something because I'm a political yeah. scientist.
Well, okay. So I should note that I'm a feminist sociologist. And so as a feminist sociologist, we'd like to look at we have this utopic view that the division of labor, that the gender division of labor in the family is not so static and not so biologically based, and that anyone could provide quality care, and that we have to question our assumption of why we feel compelled to think that certain individuals are more likely to give us care than others. Right. So why is this? So where is this ideology coming from? Is what I'm trying to figure out in the project. And so I think, is there something to be said about the longing of children? Yes, because it's a very real experience for them. It's like they're seriously longing to be with their mother, and it's a very painful experience. However, the source of that pain is that which we need to analyze. What is aggravating that pain? And why is the fact that a tremendous amount of care provided by others cannot be adequate substitutes? And so I feel that if we dismantle certain ideological beliefs we've been given, the experiences of the children would improve. It would be it wouldn't be perfect. Yes, of course, it would be horrible to be separated from people you care about, and it would be nice to give them the option to see each other once in a while. But yeah, but I think there's many ways that we could ease that pain.
Just if I could interject yeah. a comment, which is that, I mean, the reverse way to think about it is also the children that these women are caring for in our societies here, and, you know, why that becomes sort of okay, so to speak, and you know, the reverse is not. But I don't want to have a few more questions. Yes.
By the way, I just want to say I'm Filipino.
Okay.
And I have a Filipino mother, so I know the whole micromanaging thing.
Oh, okay.
I totally relate to that. But going back to like the division of labor, and you know, the feminist ideas that you're presenting, Because I know a lot of family friends who are migrant workers, and they have children my age in the Philippines, and I never looked at it from a gender point of view.
Yeah.
But I mean, what do you think is the reason for this idea that women should stay in the home in the Philippines? Like, this whole idea of domesticity, like, do you think it's because the Philippines is a dominantly Roman Catholic society, yeah, or do you think it comes from other things?
The question of why is there such an ideological stronghold about women being maternal, let's say. I mean, I think it's many factors. Yes, Catholicism, religious beliefs play a huge role in it. That's not the only factor that shapes this. I think culturally, I mean, have you heard this expression? It's like women are the men are the haligi ng tahanan and women are the ilaw ng tahanan. And it's like haligi ng tahanan means like the pillar of the home. So literally he's like a builder of the home, the man. And then the woman is ilaw ng tahanan means she's the light of the home. So she brings light to the home. And so I think this, so it's not that like I preceded Catholicism, this idea of women being the light of the home. So I think that just culture and tradition like in the Philippines dictates that. But at the same time, it's not enclosed. I want to say it's not enclosed in the Philippines, right? So what I was trying to conclude my talk with is the point that we cannot look at gender relations in the Philippines in a vacuum, but we have to look at it as situated in a larger global economy. And that, so for instance, my point was that women, Filipino women, are not just naturally suited domestic workers. The construction of Filipino women as naturally suited domestic workers did not just come from the Philippines, even though the state keeps on promoting that in their brochures. But it's also constructed by the demand of these employers in all these different destinations throughout the world. And so if you talk to employers in Hong Kong, let's say, they'll tell you, oh, Filipinos are such great, are so great with children, that's why we hire them. And so that did not come from the Philippines, right? So it's multiple forces is the point. Yes.
Hi. I'm just wondering, these women probably send back remittances to their home countries, right, to
yes,
their families. So one, do these remittances, I mean, are they in the control of the father who might be a drunkard, or the elder
yeah,
daughter who's, you know, taking care of the house probably
yeah,
and maybe transforming
yeah,
gender relations
yeah,
in the house like that? And two, do these kids say that, well, these gifts that we're getting,
yeah,
you know, they're rationalizing their parents not, the mother not
yes,
being there by saying that these gifts mean something. And,
yeah,
you know.
What I found is that women rarely send money to their husbands. But first, I think I should qualify that many of the women who leave their children behind are more likely to do so because they had problems with their husbands to begin with. So there's this myth that says that women leaving behind their husbands causes marriages to fall apart. But what I found in my study was that women were more compelled to leave if they had problems to begin with. So the mothers would, interestingly enough, not necessarily, however, give it to the grandmothers and to the aunts, but they often would give it to the eldest daughter. And so you could see then that there would be a, that would raise conflict, that would engender conflict in the family, because in the Philippines, the hierarchies are often determined in the family by age. And so then the daughter would have a tremendous power over the aunt and the grandmother, and then that would disrupt the social order of the family a bit. But why do mothers do that? It's because they like to micromanage their household. So what I found was mothers would dictate to daughters how to spend that money. And so then the mothers, even though they're gone, they will try to be like an omnipresent figure in their children's lives. But then, of course, a lot of daughters abuse this. And a lot of daughters, you know, will spend like the money on frivolous material goods. Yeah.
What strikes me as I'm listening to you is that you have a story about two different systems, if you will, that come together around this notion of the feminist notion of how we think about caring and,
yeah,
and women's roles. That on the one hand, it's a system about caring. On the other hand, it's the system about the economy, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's really important probably to disentangle the ideologies of caring it's not just about why we think women are good carers, but why we don't think men are,
yes.
why we think biological mothers yeah. are, but aunts aren't,
yes.
and so forth. So what are the structures that feed the other side of the equation,
yeah.
as well as the pro-maternalist side of the equation, but also what are the structures, this global economy question, that make it more and less likely that women are, in fact, going to be able to contribute
yeah.
to the economy of the household in particular ways. Men are or aren't in particular ways. I'm particularly struck with the elder daughter story
yeah.
that you've got here. You know, what is the economic niche that elder daughters are beginning to fulfill
yes.
in this economy?
Yeah.
So that maybe one way of disentangling your story is to disentangle the caring piece from the economic contribution piece and ask both the positive and negative on each of those
yeah.
cases for why women can do this and men can't,
yes.
et cetera.
Yes.
And
yeah.
so you sort of deconstruct
yeah.
that overall picture of it's just sort of this great monolith of patriarchy
yeah.
or whatever.
Yeah. No, your point actually raises the missing link in my talk, which is the extended kin factor that allows this to happen, right? And so if we look at transnational families from a structuration perspective, right, you will then assume that mothers leaving their kids with the fathers will just, the structure of it makes it impossible to sustain the ideology that you are going to see changes in practices inevitably. And the practices hopefully then will shift. It will lend itself to shifting the ideology, right? That's ideal. That's ideal scenario. However, what you have that prevents that from smoothly happening is you have all this extended kin. And you have a huge labor pool or resources of extended kin from the grandmothers to the eldest daughters, who then allow not just men to not do care work, but this is why women are even able to migrate abroad, right? So it is the strong extended kin system in the Philippines that is what allows this to operate, what I just talked about. Yeah. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've been listening to a lecture titled The Gender Revolution in the Philippines, Children and Transnational Mothers. Speaking was Rosel Pereñez, professor of American Civilization and Sociology at Brown University. Tonight's lecture was sponsored by the Boston University Center for the Study of Asia in cooperation with the Boston University Department of Sociology. We began with an introduction by Sociology Department Associate Professor Nazli Kibria. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Jared Mooney and Edward Mazulis. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.